You are listening to the best of the Jason Rantz Show on this Memorial Day Monday. Thank you so much for tuning in. We are taking the day off. I hope you enjoy some of the best of content that producer Peyton has procured. Obviously, there are mountains of content he could go through and pull from for the best of material. Here it is.
Folks, yellow light!
I'm walking here!
Good afternoon and welcome to the only show you need to get you through your Monday, to get you through the coronavirus crisis. In a world where few things are reliable, we are reliable. I'm the Jason Rantz Show, live on AM 770 KTTH. We are streaming live on the KTTH smartphone app. Got a lot to get to this hour. We only have 2 hours left in the show to do it. An Asian man slams a cop for not arresting someone illegally. Yes, that's a weird story out of Seattle. President Donald Trump cheers on some protesters, but Brian Stelter is all upset. Plus, the landlord to the Olympia council member who's stealing his property, he's going to be joining us in about 10 minutes. This hour of the Jason Rantz Show is brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage, PRMI. There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home, so let's find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
A Seattle police officer is now facing a complaint for not punishing a man who engaged in protected speech. Let's say that again. The cop did not punish a man for engaging in protected speech, which upsets another man. And that guy who's making these complaints, his name is Kurt Lynn. Kurt Lynn has some holes in his story that I think deserve some discussion. You see, Kurt is a Seattle kindergarten teacher. And on May 12th, he got into some kind of traffic altercation with a landscape owner as they were going into the Home Depot parking lot in SoDo. There was an argument. It's not quite road rage per se, but it's getting there. There was some kind of argument about one of these two individuals cutting off the other. And that's when Kurt Lynn tells King 5 that he was called a racist name.
As I drove by, they yelled out of their window, open your eyes, go back to China.
It was a racial slur that starts with the letter C.
And obviously I was disturbed by that. And as I turned into the Home Depot parking lot, I noticed that they were also turning in. The racist that had yelled those remarks claimed that he was the owner of the company, that there was nothing I could do, and he repeated his racial taunts.
Okay. If that happened, obviously that's disturbing, and I would be disturbed too. What I wouldn't do is call 911, but that's what he did, and he has every right to call 911. So he calls the police. An officer arrives on the scene, talks with Kurt Lynn about what happened, but ends up outraging this individual because he said, there's nothing we can do as officers. The speech he engaged in, while abhorrent, while disgusting, while very clearly racist, is protected speech.
He said, well, it sounds like there's no crime. It sounds like this man was using his, he's exercising his First Amendment rights, regardless of what he says or how you feel about it. He's allowed to say that because of the First Amendment.
Now, as a matter of law, the officer is 100% correct. 100% correct. People say free speech is not hate speech. Well, actually, yes, it is. There's no such thing, legally speaking, as hate speech in the context in which they want you to believe it exists. Simply saying something that's racist, including calling someone a horrible name, that is protected speech. Is it disturbing? Yes. Is it disgusting? Yes. Is it racist? 100%. But it is protected speech. Now, if that speech was delivered at the same time as a crime like an assault, then they would use that speech to make it a hate crime incident, which would qualify for higher punishment. But that's not what happened. It was some guy who, according to Lynn, said something racist. But because the officer didn't, I guess, arrest this guy, Kurt Lynn says he lost faith in humanity.
Absolutely not. So I was not satisfied with anything at any level of society, right? Bystanders, employees, security, corporate, city servants, all of them, everything at every level of society. Jeez. This was ignored.
Wow.
It was accepted.
It's ignored.
And the, right, like it's not acceptable.
It was ignored except for the fact that the cop showed up. It was ignored except for the fact that a whole bunch of media outlets are talking about it. It was ignored except for the fact that it wasn't ignored at all. I'm not entirely sure I understand at this point what Kurt Lynn wants from society at large to be heard. Well, we've heard you. It's disgusting. I'm sympathetic. I've been called slurs having to do with my identity as a Jew. It sucks when you're called it. It totally sucks. You feel bad, and then you kind of move on. Sometimes you post on Facebook to say you were just a victim of some kind of racism or bigotry. Sometimes you send a sternly worded tweet. But I'm not entirely sure I understand what this guy wants from the cops. But you see, he goes on Facebook, and this became a bigger thing. He just rips in to the officer. And that's when I started to get the vibe of maybe there's something more to this story. Maybe there's a little bit of activism in this guy's mind. Maybe he's got a political agenda. I have no clue. But I do know that I have lots of sources within the Seattle Police Department, and I started to poke around. And what was interesting, I'm told, according to the incident report that was written, I'm told, despite the fact that he says an incident report was not written, it actually was written, I'm told that on site, when the officer showed up, Kurt Lynn didn't say he was called a racial slur. According to the police incident report, I'm told, according to a source, that Kurt Lynn never said he was called the C word, ever. At some point later on, when there was a follow-up, presumably on the phone or perhaps via email, I'm assuming the phone based the way that SPD operates, only then did Kurt Lynn mention the racial slur. Now, to me, that's weird. Because if I was compelled to call 911 after a potential hate crime, whether or not it's an actual or perceived crime, I feel like if I was called the K word, which is a slur against Jews, probably the first thing coming out of my mouth, which is, that dude called me the K word. Not to put my Asian producer on the line here to put you out there. If you were called the C word and you called 911, would that not come out during your at least initial conversation with the cop? That seems like a big deal.
Seems like, you know, the subject of the call.
That's the worst part of the line that was supposedly said to him. Because he goes on to say that it was not just the C word. It was also like, go back to your country, I believe it was, or return to something like that. Like, I kind of feel like you would mention that. And so when I read the majority of his post that was pertinent to this, because a lot of it was just, could you please send it along? Let's get a lot of people paying attention to this. Towards the end there, he says, I asked what the community response would be. The officer said he knew of no directive from headquarters or SPD regarding racism, particularly racism towards Asian Americans. I asked multiple times and he outright lied every time. What was the cop supposed to do as far as coming up with a community response? The cop's not there to give you a community response. The cop is there to hear your complaint and to determine, based on his or her training, whether or not a crime was committed. A crime was not committed. Was he supposed to come up with a 10-point plan to address people who have hateful thoughts, maybe throwing them into re-education camps? What exactly is this about? Carmen Best, the chief of police, apparently called him up to apologize for all of this. And now the officer had his complaint forward to the Office of Police Accountability for review and potentially an investigation. Is that fair? Is that right? Based on this? I can't help but wonder if this is being driven by politics. And then, of course, I remembered of the PSA, which he actually does make reference to, I think, in this Facebook post, the PSA from Chief Carmen Best.
Chief Best called me and apologized. However, police department is meant to serve us. And I do expect them to do their job the right way. And so I really wanted the focus to be on the police department's response.
Not the racist, who, by the way, he says is a owner of a landscaping company, which means he could obviously put that company on blast and tell us, don't go to this person because he's a racist, which that's what I would do. If I saw the owner of a business coming up to me and giving me a hard time as a Jew or as a gay person or as whatever, a Republican, I would put them on blast in a heartbeat. But he's choosing to go after the cops. Why do you think that is? To me, that just screams activism. And I'm willing to bet there's probably more to this story. The officer was wearing a body cam. So we'll be able to find out what happened. And we'll see if what this individual says happened matches up, at least after the fact, with what presumably the officer thinks was the right move. I haven't spoken to him yet. I can't imagine he's coming back out there and saying like, oh yeah, I said, you know what? Good. I'm glad you got called a racial slur. Like, I don't quite understand what this is about. And that makes me suspicious. Now, if you're equally suspicious and you want to help me shine a spotlight and back the blue, text the keyword RANTS, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll send you a link to my story. Text the keyword RANTS, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770. I'll send you a link to the story. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
Olympia City Councilwoman Renata Rollins posted an open letter on Medium.com to get attention for a stunt where she is refusing to pay her rent, even though she can actually afford it. She's participating in a rent strike to bring attention to folks who can't afford to pay their rent during the coronavirus pandemic. As we've said on the show many, many times, if you are in a position where you can't actually afford to pay, rather than steal property, which is what she's doing here, you should have a good faith conversation with your landlord. They're not the evil people that a lot of activists make them out to be. In fact, my next guest is one of those people who's not an evil landlord. Rollins' landlord, Zach Kostouras, is the owner of Prime Locations in Olympia. He's not too pleased with what the Olympia City Councilwoman is doing, and he joins me now. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I almost said Seattle City Council because these are the types of stunts that we generally see in Seattle, but not necessarily Olympia. So she posted her letter online, but did she talk to you about her decision beforehand?
No. She posted her letter, and then we got her email with her basically notifying us that she wouldn't be paying rent probably 3 or 4 days after that.
And in this email, which she actually posted to Medium.com, it appears that she's lying to you. She says that her economic situation has changed and giving you the impression that she can't actually afford to pay the rent. She tells King 5 over the weekend she can, in fact, afford to pay the rent. So what was your response when you started to review not just her letter, but this open letter that she posted on Medium?
So I actually didn't even know that she had posted that on Medium at the time we got her email telling us that she wouldn't be paying rent. And so my employee who manages that particular property followed up with her the same way that we have fallen up with every single resident who has been unable to pay rent thus far, and basically reached out to her and said, hey, we got your letter or your email. We have a quick form we'd like you to fill out so we can get a little bit more information about your individual situation. And once we have that information, we can figure out how to best work with you, is essentially what the form we send them says. And one of the questions on the forms is, have you lost your job or had your pay reduced or had a reduction in hours, essentially? And the answer was no. And then there was another question that says, well, do you have any specific requests for the landlord? And her response was, well, my only request from the landlord is that they adhere to the governor's order to work out a reasonable payment plan with their tenants if requested. And then she went on to say that her only real economic change was that the current economic situation in the country had changed because of COVID, and basically that she needed to save resources for an unknown future.
Is she taking advantage of the eviction moratorium as best as you understand the governor's eviction moratorium?
Yeah, I think that certainly she's trying to leverage the ability to not be evicted into some sort of a greater cause that she feels passionate about. I think that my real purpose for writing my response was exactly to combat that, which is, hey, if you have a difference of opinion, that's fine, but use the proper channels to explore and explain that and have a conversation about it. But don't put a whole bunch of other people at risk who don't necessarily know what the outcome for them would be if they made the decision to take your advice and not pay their rent. And certainly don't do it at a time where the whole country is reeling and trying to figure out, where do we go from here? How do we survive? That requires working together. I don't think the tact that she used is the right way to get us as a country to where we all want to be.
Zach Costoros is the owner of Prime Locations in Olympia. He's the landlord of this Olympia City Councilwoman Renata Rollins, who is choosing not to pay her rent. She can afford to pay her rent. She's choosing not to because she wanted to, quote-unquote, start a conversation about the rent strike movement, which we were all having last week and the 2 weeks leading into it. It turns out, when you look at the national data, Zach, the rent strike movement itself was a failure, at least if you are, you know, looking at the amount of people who are choosing not to pay their rent year over year. It's only down about 2%, which can very easily be explained away not by political activism, but by the fact that there are, in fact, some people who are struggling to get by. You know, rather than villainize folks like you, you know, we've said over and over and over again, most landlords are good people. A lot of them are small business owners. All you have to do is have a conversation with them, and they'll probably accommodate to the best of their ability. And it sounds like, at least in the cases of, what, about 100 or so residents of yours, you're trying to work with people who can't actually afford to pay the rent.
Absolutely. And I think that was one of the main points that I wanted to make in my response was, listen, we've let people for too long give the impression that landlords and tenants can't stand each other and they're just always in conflict and it's this horrible relationship. And we manage about 1,500 apartment units throughout the South Puget Sound region. And I can tell you that 98% of the time, we all get along pretty darn well. They appreciate what we provide. We appreciate what they provide. And it's actually a pretty good relationship. But we've allowed legislation to take place. We've allowed policies to be enacted. Maybe at times that, you know, they think they're good ideas, but the reality is we're allowing these 2% of people, as you stated, maybe the rent strike folks, to be really loud and really aggressive and really negative. And then what that does is it makes people think that, oh, geez, landlords and tenants, we got to fix something. Something's wrong here. While it's not perfect, and certainly there are times where we need to address things that aren't perfect, it's nowhere near what people like Renata and the people in the rent strike movement are trying to advocate for. And that was my whole point. I just want people to see, listen, most of us are getting along really well. And this experience, COVID-19, has actually shown that more than anything else, that, hey, most landlords and most tenants are figuring out a way to work together. We actually do care about each other, contrary to what they might say or think. And I just want people to know that. I want people to know that the vast, vast, vast majority of the comments we've gotten, the responses that we've gotten, have been very pro pay your rent if you can, very pro if somebody can't pay their rent, let's work with them, and very anti rent strike. It's not American.
And the movement in general, just I happen to think that the activists, they know that you have bills to pay. You've got to pay for water and sewer and garbage. You have to pay for the handymen who you're hiring to do the work around these apartments. Like, they know that. I view this more as a political agenda to get us down this path towards housing that is essentially free. They didn't hide that as one of their goals beforehand. They believe it's a human right, which is a ridiculous point that seems to not understand how the rental industry works, but also how housing in general is supposed to work. It's just, it's economically illiterate to think that suddenly a handful of billionaires would be able to pay for everybody's housing.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we have at times is people think that you can solve really complicated problems with really simple solutions, and that's not reality. Reality is we live in a world that is more interconnected than it's ever been, a financial system that's more interconnected than it's ever been. We live in a world where small decisions and small policy changes have ripple effects with unintended consequences. And unless you have people making those decisions who can actually see what those ripple effects just might be, you got a real chance that you're going to be making the wrong decisions. And so people can come out and they can say, hey, housing should be free. Everything should be free, or it should be cheap, or it should be affordable. And it sounds really good, but it's not that simple. Nothing is that simple. What we really need is people who are smart and understand the system and how it works to come together. And we need to trust those people to help us make the right decision.
Well, I don't, with respect, I don't think you're going to get that out of Renata Rollins. Last couple questions for you. Have you decided what you're going to do when this is all said and done, when the moratorium is lifted? Are you going to evict her? Are you going to collect?
Well, my hope is that prior to then, Renata would reach out and I'd be happy to have a conversation with her, and we can figure out a way to get her caught up on her rent and not have to, you know, deal with a potential eviction or anything like that. If she doesn't want to do that, one of the things I've been sharing with people is, hey, there, we're in a housing crisis. And I keep hearing the word housing crisis and housing crisis, and it's true in some ways, right? There are other families who are willing to pay their rent who want a home to live in. And if she doesn't want to pay for the home that we're providing for her to live in, then I'm gonna do what I have to do to make sure somebody else can get in there who will pay for it.
Good. And you know what? Frankly, I want...
I hope it doesn't come to that, but that's the choice.
The weird thing for me, and obviously this is your position to make, not mine, I would, as soon as I can, evict her, because I think it's sending the wrong message to other people who want to play with your livelihood, the people that you work for, the people that you serve as a landlord for. They are playing politics with that. And what I don't want to see happen is her get other folks who very clearly can afford to pay the rent pulling the same exact stunt, because that hurts you. It hurts your employees, and it hurts the people who are living in your apartment complexes. So I wish you the best of luck. I look forward to seeing how this is all resolved. Again, we've been talking with Zach Costoros. He's the owner of Prime Locations out in Olympia. Zach, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. When we come back, more trouble for Snohomish County Sheriff Adam Fortney. We're going to dive into it in the Big Local when we return right here on the Jason Rand Show. You're listening to the best of the Jason Rand Show on this Memorial Day. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH. After I went on Fox News and I blogged over at KTTH.com about the homeless being more at risk than the general population for contracting and spreading the coronavirus, arguing essentially they should be put into the system so we can get them off the street and actually cared for, I got called out by some progressives out there in Seattle saying I'm a fascist. Others said that I want to round up the homeless to put people into camps, which is, of course, a weird thing to tell a Jew. Real Change News on Twitter called me out, saying that I am falsely insinuating that the homeless are the vector of this disease and that I'm expressing some kind of prejudice and that I'm all just about, and they used a poop emoji instead of the actual term, poop emojiing on the homeless. Tiffany McCoy is the lead organizer for Real Change, and she joins me in studio. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
So here's, you took a position that said that I said that they were the vector of the disease. I didn't say that they were the vector of the disease. I said certainly they're a part of a potential that can spread it. So tell me where I'm wrong.
Yes, so correct. You did not say the words vector. However, the insinuation in your first article, by the way, I will draw a distinction from your article yesterday, which was a bit more nuanced. But there was an insinuation that the homeless will be the vector of the disease. And if I can read the subheading of your article, it says that it's not clear that we're ready for how Seattle's out-of-control homelessness will worsen the crisis. So by saying that this population needs to be forced inside, which again is not the recommendations from health professionals, it is being able to self-isolate, which folks who are living outside are not able to do. So that's the thing that we had an issue with. We also had an issue with calling out the city council for failing to act to give the navigation team the power to force people inside.
Navigation team, by the way, is a group of specialized cops and social workers that go into the camps are the ones who are clearing the camps and sometimes giving up to 70, depending on the circumstances, 72 hours notice that they're going to do this. They don't go ahead and just randomly clear in those cases unless they have, they believe, room for them indoors.
And that is the original mission of the navigation team. But as we've seen with reports that are data driven from the navigation team themselves, now only 4% of sweeps that are done by the navigation team give that 72 hour notice. So 96% of sweeps that are taking place are within 10, 30 minutes, an hour, and folks are not always offered shelter at that time. The navigation team's own data shows that they are only offering folks, there's an ability to offer 12 beds a day. We simply don't have enough shelter to bring everyone inside. So that's the issue that I took with your claim that we could just, well, I don't think we should force anyone into a shelter. I can go into many reasons why our vendors at Real Change do not choose certain shelters to go into because they are veterans, they have PTSD, there are issues with bed bugs, there are issues with different trauma, they have to leave their pet outside, they can't go in with their significant other, they have to be in by six, out by six. That's why we at Real Change really push for Tiny House Village expansion and expanding the 24-hour enhanced shelters. And if we had more of those and the navigation team was able to actually direct people into those shelters, we would be on the same page.
Now, to be fair, half of that is going to come to fruition. Obviously, the Seattle City Council just passed this increase in the amount of tiny home villages. And I've been of the position, I think I've been pretty clear on this, where as long as you're actually including the community in that conversation as to the location, I'm generally okay with these facilities. I live nearby one. It hasn't been the hellhole that some people anticipated it to be, but it's also not necessarily a low barrier tiny home village, which has been very problematic in the limited time that we've done it in Seattle. Do you believe that the homeless are at a higher risk of contracting and spreading the coronavirus, which was my point?
Without a doubt.
So you agree with my main point. You disagree with maybe the way that I phrased some of it.
I would say that I agree more with your point from your second article that you published yesterday, which I think was more nuanced and just outlined what you just said to me. That argument that you put forward in the first one was that they will worsen the crisis, as I just read.
Yes, if they get it, they will 100% worsen the crisis. And it sounds like, because you agree at least that they're more susceptible to it, and we understand based on the limited data that we have so far that it is more contagious than the flu. What that rate is still trying to be figured out because we don't do all the testing that we should probably be doing in the state and in the country. But if we're dealing with a virus that can be spread faster than the flu, and a group of people who are more susceptible to getting it get it, then of course it is going to worsen the crisis. It doesn't mean that people are going to die, because the rate of death is rather low unless you come from a particular demographic. Elderly, dealing with some sort of underlying health condition, you're not likely to die based on the data that we have. But to suggest that somehow it won't make the situation worse seems disingenuous to me.
Yes, that's fair. And taking that in an isolated instance, we're on the same page that this population, if contracts it, are much more vulnerable based on the elements of living outside. Agreed. Disagree with your solutions. Disagree that the navigation team should have the power to force people inside. That's a civil rights issue. And also, we don't have enough shelter. The data from HSD, the city, the navigation team, over and over and over tells us that we don't have enough shelter. So your solutions that you proposed is what we take issue with. And this idea that you could just round folks up, put them inside, and then we would be able to contain it. You're actually, that's against what public health officials are saying is best. This population isn't able to self-contain. And I'm hoping that this motel that King County, Dow Constantine just purchased, you know, I'm hoping that that gets turned into shelter.
Plus the modular units that are being placed in White Center.
I'm hoping that those are turned into shelter after this. You know, we've been in the state of emergency for homelessness since 2015. We haven't made these significant funding measures into actually building shelter to get people inside. But when we have this coronavirus, right, it was the right decision to build this motel. But I'm really hoping that we're able to make these quick decisions to get people inside. So that's where we disagree, is with the solution that you proposed, and just calling out the city council as being anti-navigation team.
They're
not.
Are.
They're not anti-navigation team. We are looking at the data, and the data shows very clearly.
Are they critical of the navigation team?
Of course.
Do they want to cut staff members and funding into the navigation team, which is what they tried to do twice now?
Councilmember Sawant is the only one that has.
No, that is not true. Lisa Herbold, as well as I believe Teresa Mosqueda, last year voted in support of cutting, I believe it was nine, it's between seven and nine staff members. The mayor's office then got involved and said, no, don't do that. And then they reversed course. So to suggest that it's just Shama Sawant is not true. Real quick, if you're just joining us, Tiffany McCoy is joining in studio. She's the lead organizer for Real Change. We're talking about the homelessness crisis and sort of the intersection of the coronavirus and the potential for it to spread. So to be very clear as to what I was saying about quote unquote forcing, in the article, it's linked directly to the Marysville approach, which I 100% endorse, which simply says this. If you're breaking the law and you're homeless, you should be given two options, or three options in total. Number one, take us up on our offer of shelter or whatever else is being offered. Resources, help will connect you with where you need to be. If you say no, well, then you have two other options. We're either going to punish you for breaking the law, or we're just going to have you move. And I think that in, speaking of data, in Marysville, it's been working. Now, I think a fair argument to come back at that is saying Marysville and Snohomish County in general, much smaller certainly than Seattle and King County. That is true. But this idea that there's no actual leverage that an officer or a navigation team can have with someone who just does not want to get the help that we're offering or is not in a mental space to accept the help that we're offering is why so many people are still living it on the streets. The same people politically, ideologically, have been in charge for the last decade plus, and the situation has gotten worse. Is it possible that now is the time to try something even a little bit different?
So the idea of forcing people into shelter, when I've already made very clear, and the navigation team has made very clear, we do not have enough of.
We don't have enough, to be fair, because people are not saying yes. Now, if everyone said yes, you are 100% correct. But obviously, you can't just build a whole bunch of shelters if people are saying no. If you don't have the mechanism to say, look, you can't stay here, right? We're either going to move you, we're going to arrest you if you're breaking a law, or we're going to put you in the shelter. It's up to you. If people are saying no to the shelter, why would the city then put all of this extra money into shelter space that might not be used because we're not having any sort of leverage over the individuals?
Yeah, I would suggest that we look at what type of shelter is being offered. It's very clear that folks, if offered 24/7 enhanced shelter where they can leave their belongings and where they can go in with their loved one, when they could bring a pet, those are taken up. Those beds are always full. There's virtually just like one a day. Same with tiny house villages. Those are always full and people always virtually
tiny houses
say yes
for sure
to those.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about a map.
But they don't always say yes to those. And
they're
so for the
they're
folks,
full except for one bed a day.
They're not always full. And I've been with the navigation team, thankfully connecting someone, offering them the tiny. This was when the tiny home village in South Lake Union had just opened, offering them that space, and they said yes. But there were also people there who said absolutely no, and I was there and I witnessed that. And so for the folks who say no, the position can't simply be, okay, well, I guess go about your day. No, you either get swept into a new position, or you're arrested if you're breaking the law, if they're refusing to say yes to our offers. I get the point that, you know what, it's not as convenient. There are clearly some downsides to that, right? But at some point, it's still better than living out on the streets. It is. Do you disagree with that point?
We don't have enough shelter that folks want to go into where they can keep their belongings and be with their loved one or their pet and be in a place that might not trigger PTSD or other issues. We have a lot of veterans out on the street. We don't have enough wraparound services. We don't have enough housing to move folks from shelter into. These are the issues that we focus on.
But folks are not simply living out on the streets because they don't have access to housing. They had access to housing at some point and then they got on a path through many reasons, some through no fault of their own. They lost a job. They found themselves in financially tough spots. We also know that a lot of folks who are living out on the streets are, in fact, living with a mental illness that's not being treated, an addiction that's not being treated. They're the ones who are saying, no, those are the ones who I agree need wraparound services, but I don't trust the city to get that done. I would sooner go with someone like the Seattle Union Gospel Mission or any of these private partnerships that the city could choose to go with. They don't always do it to get that service. And then I'll leave you the last word.
So I want to go back to your Marysville example. You gave a dichotomous suggestion. You proposed that they're breaking the law or they go inside.
No, if they're breaking the law.
So
if they're not breaking the law, then you move them. But continue.
So, yeah, I want to just again get back to this idea that everyone outside is breaking the law and the need to be forced into shelter. And I want to get back again to why I believe you invited me here in the first place was by calling out the fact, the conflation that the homeless population is going to be this vector of the disease. What's actually interesting is what we have seen through data and the spread of it. The vector of the disease are middle and upper class folks who have the wealth to travel internationally and then bring the disease back. And we unfortunately, with the CDC, are not in a position to be able to contain this virus. And all of the folks that are living outside are in an extremely vulnerable position because we don't have enough housing. We don't have enough shelter. And this idea that the navigation team, which is not doing its stated mission anymore, it is not doing primarily 72-hour sweeps to get people inside. That's the navigation's own data. I would suggest people go and look at their most recent reporting.
And look at the context of that, because in a lot of those cases, and I think you'll acknowledge it, they're doing that because of an emergency situation. Now, there may be a disagreement as to whether or not you would declare it an emergency, and I think that that's fair, but that's what they're declaring it. And the fact of the matter is, obviously, you can't just be camped out anywhere you want without any regard for other people and businesses. And I think that's an important part.
Completely. We would not purport that whatsoever. But I also want to get back to your description of the navigation team as like equally police presence and equally social workers.
I never said equally. I said it's a group of professionals. Now, when I've gone, there have been when I've gone, it's been the larger encampment, so there have been more of both sides.
And REACH, which is this really important outreach service, has in the last year declined to continue with the navigation team. And I would suggest your listeners, I don't want to paint the picture, go and read up on your own why this very effective outreach group decided to not work with the navigation team anymore. The navigation team is primarily now a police presence, and that is not going to encourage folks to go with them to get into these shelters that are not going to give them the wraparound services that we need.
There you go. How do we learn more about Real Change?
Go to realchangenews.org. I'm in the advocacy department, wholly separate from the newsroom. We are a low barrier employment opportunity for folks.
There you go. Tiffany McCoy, lead organizer for Real Change. Thanks for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. We're back right after this. You are listening to the best of the Jason Rand Show on this Memorial Day Monday. Thank you so much for tuning in. We are taking the day off. I hope you enjoy some of the best of content that producer Peyton has procured. Obviously, there are mountains of content he could go through and pull from for the best of material. Here it is. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH, streaming on the KTTH smartphone app. A rabid environmental activist confronted and verbally assaulted Todd Myers as he walked out of testimony against Washington's greenhouse gas emission targets. Todd is the director of the Center for the Environment at Washington Policy Center. Here's how a part of that interaction actually unfolded.
What you just said.
You deserve to suffer and die and suffer in hell as much as all the billions of lives and life forms that will suffer more because of your words, because of your rhetoric and your debate team tactics at twisting the truth and making a buck. Yeah, I don't know how you can live with yourself making a buck off of damage to biology.
Todd Myers is not living in internal damnation, and it turns out he is able to sleep at night. He joins me on the line right now. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, take us through how you got to the point where you ended up starting the video, because obviously you started the video in the middle of this action.
Right. So, I had testified earlier in the day on Washington's proposal to tighten our greenhouse gas emission targets, which is ironic because we're not meeting the current greenhouse gas emission targets, so we're tightening them. And I pointed out some problems with that. One, that it doesn't take into account what the cost is and the cost and benefits. Are there better things that we could do with that money, either to improve the environment or health and welfare? He sat next to me and started his testimony by insulting me. And then when I was walking out of the room, he jumped up and got 2 inches from my face and started calling me all sorts of names. And then when I left, he followed me. I asked one of the ushers or the guards outside, can you get this guy away from me? And they said, look, just walk away. So I walked away and he followed me. So then he told me that people like me should be in prison for what I was saying. And I said, well, if this guy's going to follow me, I might as well turn on my camera. Mm-hmm. So I turned on my camera. And what you can hear right at the beginning there is where I say, what did you say? What did you say? Say it again. Because he saw me turn on my camera. That's when he said what he said. And there's a, you know, we have posted at WashingtonPolicy.org the entire video. It's more than 6 minutes. And the part that you heard isn't even actually the craziest part.
Yeah, you shared with me a portion of the conversation where he goes after you for talking against bees. So set up and then we'll play the audio.
Yeah, so apparently what he says there, and he says we have met before. I don't remember ever meeting him, but he talked about how all the bees are dying and that I mocked him for that. And what I say, I am a beekeeper. And so I told him, look, I'm a beekeeper. Nobody cares more about honeybees than me, and I'm willing to get stung, you know, 10 times a year because I love bees. But I don't like the hysteria, about honeybees. There are problems facing honeybees, but populations are going up, not down. Now, what he conflates is he says, well, wild bees, and there are some wild bees that are in danger, but what he asked me about was honeybees. And what you hear, you'll hear next is the way what he said to me about that.
I made a point a few years ago that we need bees and bees are in danger of extinction. And you mocked me in public and then said, I'm a beekeeper and bees are actually doing great.
I said, honeybees are increasing.
And you can take any point and do that while bees are going extinct, you bastard, you monster. Bees are going extinct and you're making debate points.
So as this was happening, Todd, what was going through your head?
Well, I will tell you, that's toward the end of the video, and I've never had somebody do it to that extent. I've had people challenge me, and that's fine, and I don't mind that, but this guy was following me, and I was getting close to my car, and I was starting to get worried about what he would do when I reached my car. But I just, like I said, I thought that he should be on video, that people should see who this is. And he is not just some random person. He is one of the co-founders of 350 Seattle, which is probably the leading climate environmental group in Seattle. They work with the city of Seattle all the time. They work with other environmental groups. So he's part of a major environmental group that has influence in Washington State.
So he's been identified as Michael Foster. I've reached out to him to see if he wants to come on the show, even though, frankly, it terrifies me. He won't be in studio for sure. If he agrees to do it, we'll have to do it over the phone. But you say you've never actually had any contact with him before, but take us through a little bit of that organization and really kind of the work that they've done.
Well, 350.org, like I said, is very influential, but they are one of the most radical. In fact, last year they signed on to a proclamation saying that we shouldn't have not only coal and natural gas, but we shouldn't have hydro, nuclear, or even biomass, which is like in Spokane, we have a biomass plant that burns wood, or even garbage as a renewable resource, which they do in Europe all the time, that the only things that are allowable are basically wind and solar, which would eliminate more than 90% of the electricity. And this is really outrageous, and it's just ridiculous. There's no way that we could live like this, and it's not even productive, right? There's no reason to say we can't have nuclear, that we can't have hydro, which are carbon-free sources of energy that are necessary, that help us deal with intermittence like solar and wind. So that they're really radical, ideologically driven, and as you can tell by the audio there, that's the kind of person who is leading this and founding this organization.
Yeah, and that's the kind of person that Democrats in Olympia are listening to, and that should be the most concerning of all.
Yeah, I think, like I said, they have 350 Seattle has worked with the city of Seattle. 350 nationally is certainly part of consulting with major Democratic presidential candidates. Now, I want to make it clear that I think that we should do things about climate change. I think the risk is much less than other people think, but I think it's worth doing, but it's worth doing right. And the things that really work are things that come out of the market, not come out of politicians. So what's ironic is that I get attacked. Sometimes people on the right don't like the fact that I acknowledge that there is risk there. But this just shows how radical these folks are, that even that message is not even nearly enough for them. And I am, you know, I should die, and I'm a monster.
Well, Todd Myers, you're not a monster to us, but we do appreciate your willingness to go up against actual unhinged monsters who want to yell at you in public like that. You can watch the full video. It's over 6 minutes long at washingtonpolicy.org. We've been talking with Todd Myers. He's the director of the Center of the Environment at the Washington Policy Center. Todd, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the Jason Rancho.